WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going to be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. My name is Kevin Tachi, and we have yet another great show lined up for you. The idea of a show like this is to kind of give you different aspects of what's going on, not only in the local community. It doesn't necessarily have to just focus solely on politics or one singular issue. It could be, again, it's the purpose of the show is to be kind of like a magazine show, to talk about arts and entertainment, speak with your local book authors, and have a chance to speak with local elected leaders, whether they are on the municipal level or on the state level and beyond. Just so you know, in a bit, we'll speak with Mr. Tyler Morris. Tyler is a musician. We actually had him on the show recently, as recent as, I want to think, March or April. And he was with a Van Halen tribute band called Cathedral. Well, Tyler is actually out promoting a new album. He actually is going to be performing right here in the area this week, Soundcheck Studios. You've heard of them, right, in Pembroke? So we'll talk with Tyler about his little tour, New England tour, and talk a little bit about the new album. Then we're going to speak with Mr. Thomas Curran. You talk with him about his new book called All Hold Hands. And the idea of his book is the exploration of country dance, New England country dance. You would think with when it comes to country music and dance, well, it might be something that originates in the southern part of the country. Au contraire, Mr. Curran is going to kind of give us the details and exploration into this 10,000-year art. And then we're going to close things out with a gentleman who actually have a podcast called The Causeway Kings, and they are all about talking hockey. We have Adam Clancy and Benny Rabbi, and we will talk about everything that have to do with the 2022-2023 NHL season right up until the draft just a couple of weeks ago. But we kick things off, as we usually do, the State House Report. And joining us this week, he is Mr. Matt Muratori, a state representative serving the 1st Plymouth District, primarily Plymouth. Representative, how are you, sir?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
You got it. Well, you're a reoccurring theme. It's the idea is just to try to keep folks up to date with what's going on up at the State House, primarily with your discussion would be in the House of Representatives. I had a chance to kind of see state government in action last Thursday. And of course, I will say that I have a little bit of a selfish reason because the piece of legislation that was discussed in a joint committee has to do with my full-time job. As folks may or may not know, I am the executive director of Abington Community Access and Media. And these days, with people cutting the cord, folks looking for other inexpensive alternatives, the monies that Comcast and Verizon and any other cable provider put forth to PEG Access centers like mine and many of the ones that do a great job on the South Shore, once the subscribers drop, that's where the revenue is that they provide us with our licensing, with our franchise fees. And to have a chance to sit in on the Joint Committee on, correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, the Joint Committee on Advanced Technology, the Internet, and Cybersecurity. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Yep.
So for folks who don't know, tell us a little bit about the, I guess you had a senator, and you also had State Rep Joe Moschino. Tell us who was part of this and what the bill is that was put forth before this committee.
Yeah, sure. And thank you for giving us the time to kind of talk about this. And thank you for actually testifying as well. It was a packed room. There were a number of bills that were hearing, but this bill got a lot of the attention. It's Bill 874, and it's called an Act to Modernize Funding for Community Media Programs.
Wow.
And it was filed by Rep. Joe Moschino and myself, and Senator Lewis on the Senate side as well. And the senator and I were able to testify along with Julie Thompson from PAC TV in Plymouth. We did a panel discussion and really kicked it off and explained the reasons why we need to get this this bill on a committee and passed on the House and Senate floor.
The thing that I found interesting was the concerns of the committee, especially one committee member who had made mention that with the excess in revenue that the state is seeing, wouldn't it just be simpler to provide an appropriation to those communities who are steadily losing cable subscribers and kind of offset it that way? Because the idea of this bill is to basically assist in where community access centers are losing a percentage of, I mean, because all of them are funded up to 5%, depending on what their agreement is with said cable providers. And the idea is just to kind of backfill this so that they're at least maintaining the 5%, not necessarily trying to generate a new source of revenue and be, you know, something above and beyond, but just, you know, to kind of backfill what they're losing.
Yeah. And as you said, you know, the Comcast and the Verizons of the world, you know, people are cutting the cord and they're not, you know, they're not using cable subscription. They're going to streaming services. And they're using, you know, Hulu and, you know, Netflix and things like that. And so, but there's no fees associated with them. So we're trying to level the playing field and also just trying to make sure that the access stations are still funded. Now, just to explain to people how they're funded, it's through the cable bill. There's a fee associated with that. The municipalities, the towns, and the cities have agreements to have cable services in their communities, you know, through one of these, you know, Comcast, Verizon, et cetera. And part of it is that fee would go, a small portion of the fee would go to access stations like in Plymouth, we have PAC TV to operate. What's been happening, and it was kind of astounding to hear, you heard it as well, is some of the numbers from some of the communities that Senator Lewis, you know, mentioned that, you know, the percentage of people in his community that have cut off cable, some up to 50% of the communities that have cut off cable. That's a serious issue for, you know, for access stations. And I think it was Senator Turcotte that indicated that, well, why don't we just use money from, you know, the state funds? Well, that's terrific. We're talking about $68 million. If you can do that as a permanent structure, that would solve the problem. But I'm not sure there's a willingness in state government to actually do that.
And you know of other nonprofits that probably seek annual assistance from the state, and it's not anything that is given. And knowing that there's the ongoing discussion, right, to say, hey, can you make sure you appropriate to this, yeah, very important organization that provides this very important service to people in need, knowing that it's not easy and it's not promised. I'm not sure if it's a, you know, the reason that was given by one of the committee members was, well, they didn't want to burden taxpayers any further, seeing that they had to go in, because Comcast and cable bills continue to rise. They keep going up.
Right.
And people are looking for, you know, ways and, you know, cheaper ways to be able to watch something beyond just the basic, you know, local programming. And, you know, he's like, well, we don't want to like incur further fees on them where they have just found. But I think you had made the mention that during COVID, PEG access stations served a vital role in providing information and keeping folks up to date with what was going on, and even entertainment, just to kind of help pass the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if any of us learned anything out of COVID, it was that, you know, the access stations were the lifeline to our government and to, in some cases, you indicated, to, you know, what's happening in the outside world, but particularly to government and its crucial role that plays in government. And you look at the meetings that are produced by folks at access stations like yours. Your select board meetings, your planning board meetings, your zoning meetings, your town meetings. Without that access to people having access to it, where would the democracy really be? Newspapers are diminishing. That was discussed. You know, you don't have that anymore. Coverage from, you know, local stations like, you know, WATD is not as readily available at local board meetings anymore either. So your access stations are where it's at. So I think everyone agrees that there's value in it. The question now becomes, how do you actually get the funding for it? I mean, we propose a 5% fee to streaming services, but that's not the way we have to do it. We don't want to make money on it. We want to make sure that whatever the cable companies were giving and now the municipalities are losing for the access stations, that it's made up through the streaming services.
So what happens now?
So, well, as you heard, there was a lot of discussion. There were a lot of panelists that came forward. Now the committee will, I think it's clear with their assets, they're struggling with, the funding part of it. So I think that's something that we need to, you know, work with them on, work with the administration, the Healy administration on, to find out what the most effective way to do this without hurting consumers, you know, any more than what they are. So I think that's where we're at, is working with the committee. I think one of somebody from MassAccess said, you know, we're probably 5 to 10 years away from, you know, funding being real eliminated, but we can't eliminate these access stations, and we won't, but we've got to come up with a solution sooner than later. So we're going to continue to work with the committee to try to get it out of committee and work on that funding.
And one last note on this item, and that is kudos to Julie Thompson, who I think she hit the nail right on the head as to all the high points. And if anything, fortified what yourself and Senator Lewis may have mentioned, or even John Moschino. I feel as though it's like the glue to the conversation. Julie always on top of things. And I myself thank her for, you know, being the first Access Center director to at least be able to put forth her thoughts and concerns. And also shine a little brighter light on what exactly it is that local television does, local media outlets do.
Yeah, and I think one of the striking things she said was that, you know, pretty much during COVID, where everything was shut down, they were going full steam ahead. Mm. They had no choice. They had to keep producing and keep moving government forward. So, but, you know, and I think Joan Moschino, who's really the lead on this, and we really thank Joan for leading this charge,
yes,
made some great points on that as well. And it just can't go away, Kevin, and that's the point of this. Everyone agrees with it. We just need to figure out how it gets funded.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Representative Matt Muratori and just doing a little bit of a State House report. Let's do a little bit of a pivot here. And the budget, we still await a budget to escape the conference committee. To this date, what are you hearing? Because I know that you would anticipate a lengthy session once this thing is released. I believe the Senate would have to do the same thing. What are you hearing as to when this could be let out of conference committee and to the House?
Well, you know, Kevin, I'm on the House Ways and Means Committee with the budget, and so I've been in contact with a couple of the members on the conference committee. And there's a lot of agreement. Majority of it is agreed upon. There are some areas where, you know, we just can't discuss where they are that are different between the Senate and the House. If I was a betting man, and I'm not, I would say that we probably aren't going to make the end of July at this point, because we also have to have, you know, once the House, as you indicated, you know, does their version and finalizes the conference committee report, it has to go to the Senate. They need to do it. And then the governor has, you know, 10 days to look at it and veto and do whatever she wants. And we're at, you know, day August 1st is our deadline. We're on break starting August 1st. So we're really coming to a deadline, and nobody can really think of any time in the near, in the recent future, a recent past where it's really gone past July 31st, but I'm fearful that that may happen.
Well, definitely we'll stay in touch with you and your colleagues to see what happens. And this could be something that happens relatively quick, right? You may get a notice tonight or maybe even tomorrow saying, hey, it's broken free and it's time for you to come in for a vote and a discussion. It's that quick, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And we usually find out on Friday afternoon by 5 o'clock what our session schedule is for the following week. So my guess is we're going to be potentially in session every day next week waiting for that budget.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about something else that I know that you is near and dear to your heart, and that is a convention center. What's the thoughts? Yeah. Any discussions on this? Where do things stand?
Yeah, a lot has happened since the last time we talked. As you recall, Kevin, Senator Moran, Representative Lenato, and myself were able to secure $150,000 last year for a marketing feasibility study for a convention center in Plymouth County. There was the market feasibility study done by a national group that was picked out of three different groups that provided information to us. And C. Plymouth and the Plymouth Economic Foundation were leading this charge and are leading this charge. A report came out. There were 8 to 10 different sites throughout Plymouth County. Majority of them were in Plymouth, particularly down by the waterfront in the downtown area. And there was public hearings that were held back in June. Three of them with the company. And now the next step is the Plymouth Area Economic Foundation will be putting out a request for information sometime this month. And basically that's gonna ask people to see who has an interest in kind of discussing this. Once that happens, then there'll be some discussions with the town of Plymouth if that's where, the potential developer wants it. Then with the state and the federal government, and we'll kind of go from there. And next step will have to be a RFP, request for proposal, kind of go from there. But it has real potential. The feasibility studies show that the project had I think it was like 60 or 70% of polling that was done was favorable for people to come to Plymouth for conventions. So that bodes well for major hotels. You need a major hotel to actually anchor it with 200 hotel rooms, and the convention center would be somewhere around 3,000 to 4,000 people, along with shops and restaurants and things like that. So it's a good sized project. It's probably about a $75 million project, and it'll be a public private partnership.
So there is Memorial Hall in downtown Plymouth. What's your understanding of the specs of that, and could that be a stumbling block where folks will go, well, we have something that is will host a number of people. Why do we need another?
It's not big enough. It holds about 1,300 people. It's not big enough for a convention to come through. Although that is one of the sites that was looked at, along with the 1620 hotel area, the Pilgrim Sands Hotel, the Plymouth Patuxent was looked at. So there's a few sites that are really attractive sites, for the community to handle this.
So is it possible that a new convention center could replace Memorial Hall?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Personally, I don't think Memorial Hall would be the better choice. I personally think the 1620 Hotel, where the Village Landing is more of an ideal site.
Yep.
That whole area. I also think, the 225 Water Street to the left of East Bay Grill, that area is a desirable area as well. We have to talk to the people that own these places and, these developers and, see where it can go.
What's the timeline now? What's the next couple of things that are going to, the next couple of things that need to be discussed or any meetings that are being held, just so folks who are tuned into this segment are kind of apprised, and if they want to attend or if they want to maybe watch the proceedings, what can they do?
Well, right now, as I said, it's going to be a request for information will be sent out to the world to see who has the interest. That'll probably happen July, August. So I think by the early fall, we'll have an idea of if there's interest in it. And if there is, which I believe there will be, then we'll have to sit down with C. Plymouth and the foundation. I'll have to sit down with the town of Plymouth, the board of selectmen, the town manager, and the state delegation as well, the federal delegation, kind of see, you know, what it could look like, what the developer's looking for, and what sort of help that the federal, state, or local governments could actually help with.
So, again, we've been speaking with State Representative Matt Muratori. Here we are. You know, the summer seems like it's just it's going by so fast. I feel like we get to the end of June, and once we hit July, it's just like it's lightning quick. We're already talking about, I'm already seeing advertisements for back to school, clothing and apparel. And have you had a chance
next month we'll see Christmas. We'll be seeing Christmas ads next month.
That's true. Yeah, and there'll be candy on the shelves for Halloween.
Halloween.
Have you had a chance to enjoy the summer at all? Do you have anything planned to be able to kind of relax and decompress?
No, we're still pretty busy, you know, in the local level, even though this is the first time we were in session since April. But there's a lot going on in the community, so there's been a lot happening here in the community. So, I've been doing a lot of stuff around town and just enjoying the summer with the kids out of school, with the family and all that.
Anything else you want to touch upon, whether it's in district or top of mind in regards to the First Plymouth or you know, you as a state representative?
No, I just want to, you know, thank you, Kevin, and you know, thank Julie and other people throughout the state, you know, helping out with this this mass access bill. And really, we need to get more people behind it. And I would ask anybody that's listening to contact your state rep, your state senator, and ask them to talk to the chair of the committee to support H-74 so we can get out of committee and really avoid a disaster that could happen down the road in a very short time.
And I believe, can folks submit comments until the end of this week?
They can submit it to through the 22nd of July. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yep. All right. And if constituents want to reach out to you, anybody wants to touch base with you, how can they reach out to you?
Yeah, they can reach me at matthew.muratori@mahouse.gov. It's one T in Matthew. Or they can just, you know, call my cell phone at 508-930-2979.
Now, one of these times, and I've had the conversation with you, I think I've had it with Rep. Lenatra. I know Peter Brown and myself would like to have a day or two at the State House. We were planning on trying to do something either this week or maybe the following week, but it seems as though where things are, you guys are in session sporadically, that maybe it might be better to do something in the fall.
Yeah, we would love that. It's always great to have, you know, folks up there to see what's happening in the State House. Personally, I had my own brother and cousins coming out this coming Friday to the State House. They've never been to the State House. They're going to take a tour of the State House. We'll get some pictures taken. You know, it's really a historic place, and people are in awe every time they come. And so we'd love to have you up there and just kind of show you around and talk to some folks that are there.
Yeah, again, the idea would be maybe we do maybe one set of segments for one show in your office, and maybe we do one set in Rep. Lenatra's office.
Absolutely, yeah, we love it.
We'll let you guys pick and choose who, whether it's somebody from the House or maybe there's a colleague, there's somebody, a legislative colleague in the Senate that maybe you'd want to have in on a conversation to talk about stuff.
Listen, as elected public officials, we're never shy to talk to the media. It won't be a hard sell.
There he is, State Representative Matt Muratori, representing the First Plymouth District. We want to thank you, sir, again for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
You got it. We're going to step aside just for a couple of moments. Fear not. But when we come back, we're going to talk Tyler Morris. Tyler Morris coming to the local area to perform. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Few make it big in motorsports, but the real reward for most is the joy of competition. I'm Miles Heger. The excitement and danger of motorsports are the reasons drivers love to race and why fans keep showing up. Join me and my guests each week as we discuss the local short tracks while also sharing opinions and insight on the national series. Tune in to Miles on Motorsports Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. here on 95.9 WATD.
Support the Friends of the Plymouth Council on Aging Center for Active Living with the Super Summer Raffle. Tickets are on sale now. For just $100, you can win a fabulous cash prize of either $3,000 for first place, $1,000 for second place, and two chances at $500 for third place. Drawing will be held on October 2nd, but hurry up because there are only 100 slots available. For more information, please call 978-808-3895. We wish you the best of luck.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk here on 959WATD. Our next guest so happens to be a gentleman we actually had on previously as we talked with him about his tribute band, the Van Halen tribute band that he is a part of, Cathedral. Well, it so happens that he is here to talk a little bit about some exciting news, not only his new works, but also that he is going to be appearing here locally just in a few days at Soundcheck Studio. Have you been to Soundcheck Studio? It is fantastic, and every artist that wants to get word out about their music is going to Soundcheck Studios. Welcome to the show, Tyler. We have Tyler Morris, who is joining us, guitarist. How are you, sir?
I'm excellent. Thank you so much for having me.
For folks who don't know, tell folks a little bit about yourself as a musician and some of the works that you've been doing as of late.
Yeah, I've been a musician since I was 10 years old, I would say. I'm 25 now. And I'm in a variety of projects. My own band, Tyler Morris Band, which is more of a blues-based project. Cathedral, my Van Halen tribute. And the project I'm bringing to Soundcheck, which is Bonder and Morris, which is my country band.
Wow. How do you have so much time to be able to do so many different types of music?
You know, that's a good question. And it's kind of like in one essence, I don't really have that much time. But in the second essence, it's because time moves so quickly that I kind of move to different projects, and I don't want to, you know, spend too much time in one area per se. If I, you know, if I feel, you know, oh, I'm tired of doing the blues thing, you know, I like to move around, and it keeps me going. So,
my understanding is that you're hoping to help electric guitar have somewhat of a revival, a renaissance. You have a new release out called Living in the Shadows. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah. That album I did with my good friend, Mike Zito, who's a producer and done everyone from Samantha Fish, I think even Walter Trout and his own stuff. And I did that down in Texas. And it's something that's my first record I'm singing on for a large majority of. And it kind of culminates my songwriting. I had three previous records, so it kind of culminates the songwriting from then. And even the stuff I'm putting out, even since that release, was very similar to that style. So I would say Living in the Shadows is kind of like my sound-defining style. Release-wise.
Now, my understanding is that this album is already doing quite well, as it has debuted number 3 on the Billboard Blues charts. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true, and also it got a first-round Grammy nomination along with my previous record, Next in Line.
How does that feel? I mean, how do you take that as an artist when you are when your music and your work is being recognized?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's definitely, definitely honored about that. And, you know, I've been fortunate having that happen twice, that I'm actually now a voting member. I've been to the Grammys 2 years in a row. And now even going into country music, I was actually tapped by the CMA, Association, Country Music Association, to be a voting member for them as well, and to also submit other artists' music. So it's a great responsibility. And it's something that I'm honored that people trust me and my opinion, and, you know, I would say open mind with music to kind of nominate others and to vote.
Again, if folks are just tuning in, we are privileged to be speaking with Tyler Morris. If you want to find out more about Tyler while you are listening to our conversation, visit his website, TylerDMorris.com, and you can find out not only about the new album, but you can find out more about some of the other projects, and even get an idea of some of the, if you're somebody who does not live in the New England area and maybe you're hoping he may be coming to a venue near you, I would definitely check out his website to find out more information. So jumping back in and talking a little bit about, you know, your adaptability to be able to play rock and roll, play blues, or even delve into country music. I mean, is there one that you favor over the other, or is it a matter of that you have a unique appreciation for all three types of genres?
In terms of influences, I go the gamut, everyone from George Benson to Eddie Van Halen, but one of my biggest mentors is another Boston guy, originally New York, but Elliot Easton from the band Cars. And he's always said to me, if someone comes to him and you know, has a new project, and he says, oh, what do they sound like? And they say, oh, it sounds like Def Leppard meets the Stones, and they give him some combination of other bands. Mm. He's always found that that's kind of not really going to be a band he wants to listen to. If you say, well, you know, I can't really describe the sound, it's its own thing, that's more, you know, I agree too. I would say that's where bands that are iconic, from Aerosmith to the Beatles, to, you know, more modern artists, like you think about me, Jason, country genre. So for me, I focus on the songwriting. I think the genres are kind of more, you know, marketing labels. But I follow direction with the marketing team and how people think interpret the songs that I release. But, you know, my dream is to really have a band like an Aerosmith or Van Halen type of a band, where we're writing incredible songs, and then the marketing kind of falls in line from there.
Who are you listening to these days? If you're not out and you're not traveling around, who are you listening to? Are you somebody who likes listening to new music, or do you just have a preferred type of music that you'll tune into, and it doesn't matter?
Well, for me, so my favorite music has always been a lot of bands that are now considered classic, like I mentioned Aerosmith a few times, you know, Bon Jovi, and, you know, Guns N' Roses, things like that. And actually up to like Audioslave, for example, Chris Cornell, I love his, I listen to a lot of vocalists. However, a lot of, I would say, after the first two, the early 2000s, a lot of the rock music, the industrial, I do like Nickelback, for example, but I kind of moved on from listening to a lot of modern rock. I just find it almost like kind of very heavy metal at this point. And aside from the classic bands, I really kind of found my love for rock music. I think that's largely migrated to modern country. So, for example, I listened to Zac Brown Band.
Nice.
Like this week, I was listening to Zac Brown Band, and there, if you listen to a lot of their stuff, you'll get the same kind of feeling you do listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd, for example.
More of a storytelling that there's you know, not only does it have a great musical hit, a hook that you can appreciate, but it, you know, whatever the lyrics are, the substance to them. Is that accurate?
Yeah, yeah. And people, you know, one thing that I think differentiates me in particular is, you know, that even though a lot of the music I listen to doesn't have the guitar playing that like a Van Halen would have, although I do a lot of that type of a guitar playing. So I think that's one thing that kind of differentiates me. I'm trying to bring back that style of playing, but, you know, in the context of a Zac Brown or something along those lines. You know, Zac Brown, I mean, they have great songwriting. You know, they're not as solo heavy. Like, you listen to a Lynyrd Skynyrd and they have three-part harmonies.
Mm.
So, you know, I could... I mean, on a lot of the stuff I'm doing with the country band, I'm bringing a lot of solo heavy, you know, fits in the context, but, you know, a lot of those harmonies and things like that. So I'm trying to bring that back to the main mainstream. And, you know, for me, we talked about, I had a lot of accolades with the blues, but a lot of the blues crowd is kind of a, you know, the crowd is not... who your target demographic should necessarily be. I want this music to live on, and I want to do that. You have to go to teens, you know, people in their 20s, early 20s, like myself. And in the blues, unfortunately, as much as I like it to go that demographic, you know, I was selling out rooms, and the average age was 55 years old, you know, mostly male audience. And you can't really... you know, have the music live on that way. You know, I don't, you know, I love those audience members, you know, that demographic still comes to my shows, but now I see, like, at our show at Soundcheck Studios, we'll have people who are all the way from, you know, 15 years old to, you know, 75 years old, at our shows. And that's kind of what I'm aiming for, is having this music live on.
Have you had a chance to visit a venue like Soundcheck Studios or get to know what the atmosphere is like? Have you heard any feedback about the venue?
We actually played there at the Van Halen Project Cathedral, and we did very well in November. I know what it's like from a tribute standpoint, but I saw they've been doing a lot of country, and I've seen some photos. And I mean, you know, we did pretty well as the tribute, but I mean, the photos I see for the country are like 500 plus people in the room, and it's really kind of what I'm describing, where it's a very diverse audience in terms of age. So that's kind of what I'm expecting and I'm hoping we bring in on July 21st.
It's kind of interesting because you wouldn't think that the Boston area would be so welcoming to country music, but knowing, you know, maybe it might be more of like a pop or adult contemporary or maybe even R&B or rock. You mentioned Aerosmith, you know, that this is their home base. But to know that country is growing leaps and bounds, whether it's, you know, old country or some of the new country, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I was surprised as well. I go to Nashville very regularly, in L.A., and I really do find that Boston has a huge country scene. You know, I'm kind of in the same boat as you. I don't really know why it exists, but I'm happy that it does. And, you know, I don't live in some place like, for example, in Chicago. There's not much of a country scene. There's a little bit of a blues scene, but Boston, I've found, it's kind of hit or miss, where it has somewhat of a music scene. People respect music. It's not as big as like a Nashville, Memphis, or LA, but it's kind of, you know, I would say second tier in terms of excitement about music. So, you know, I'm fortunate that I don't live in a place, like I mentioned, that's like in the middle of nowhere.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we have a few more minutes. We are speaking with artist Tyler Morris.
And we're talking with him not only about his latest works, his latest release called Living in the Shadows. Again, if you want to find out more information about the new music or some of the venues he's going to be traveling around to in the New England area, visit his website, tylerdmorris.com. And again, knowing that this Friday, if you haven't had a chance to purchase your tickets, you actually can go on the website, I'm looking at it right now, and you can RSVP for this coming Friday night to be able to see his original project, or maybe you can't make it to this Friday night. Again, he's got listings going into, my goodness, till 2024, March of 2024, where there are different venues, whether it's in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Connecticut. Tyler is out and about, whether it's with Bondra and Morris, or if it is a Cathedral, that is, of course, the Van Halen tribute band. Anything that we haven't touched upon or tackled during our conversation, but you want to take a moment as we wrap up our talk here?
I would just kind of, like you said, I would just tell everyone to stay tuned, because we got a lot of exciting updates. We got, you know, I'm someone who does a lot of different projects, new projects. So I'm very active on social media at Tyler Morris Official, and I post everything there. And I tag my, I encourage you, if you're on there too, to check out the other individual project pages, because everything is a little bit different. You know, some of the projects the other band members will post, and you know, it's not all the same content. So, but I would just encourage you to follow at Tyler Morris Official. My website, www.tylerdmorris.com. And you know, we're getting to the point here where, you know, I'm doing much of my own booking. But if there's, I don't know if there's anyone listening here, you know, just looking at my schedule, but this is a lot to handle. So if you know, we're actively looking for people who want to take up a booking agent or managerial role with my brand, because, you know, it's a lot to manage. I also have a full-time engineering job as well, too. So, and that kind of fits nicely with the music as well. With my whole story, so
right, and I would also encourage folks, if you know, there's a preview on the webs on the tylerdmorris.com website. You get a preview of his album, and if you like it, go to iTunes and purchase a local artist's music. Tyler, I want to thank you so much for being my guest and sharing details not only about your new music, but also talk a little bit about, you know, your upcoming gig this Friday night at Soundcheck Studios. We wish you all the best of luck, and I'm sure that you and I will have yet another conversation somewhere down the road.
Yeah, thanks. Again, Kevin, I appreciate you for having me on. And also, we rehearse actually the Van Halen band right in Hanover, so I'd be happy to stop by the studio when it was a little hectic week this week with the shows, but, you know, I'd be happy to stop by in person, you know, when we have a little more breathing room, can, you know, kind of relax and, you know, do something in person.
There he is. Absolutely. Love to have you back in studio and chat with you, talk more about music. We are going to step aside, again, just speaking with Tyler Morris. Check him out. We are going to say goodbye to hour number one. Hour number two, straight ahead. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
The Plymouth Philharmonic Orchestra, in partnership with the Emelson YMCA in Hanover, present a free outdoor concert featuring the Phil's Cabaret Orchestra at 6:30 p.m. on July 19th at Laura's Center for the Arts. With beloved tunes from the big screen to the small screen, there is something for everyone to enjoy. The lawn opens at 6 p.m. and seating is general admission, with areas for concert goers to place lawn chairs or blankets. Guests may bring the food and beverages of their choice, and there will also be an ice cream truck. For more information, visit PlymouthPhil.org. We hope to see you there.
On Saturday, July 29th, Daniel Webster Masonic Lodge in Marshfield will be holding an open house and cookout for parents and their sons to come by and learn about DMLA International. We're located at 420 Furnace Street in Marshfield and will be there from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. For over 100 years, DMLA has been the premier organization based on timeless principles, committed to developing and inspiring leadership, team building, and networking for young men ages 12 to 21. Don't miss this event to find out how joining DMLA can give your son an advantage and set them on their path to a bright future. The road begins here.
The Veterans Voice Network and the City of Quincy present the 4th Annual Veterans Music Festival Benefits and Career Expo. If you're a veteran or a first responder, bring your family to the Pageant Field located at 1 Marymount Parkway in Quincy on Saturday, July 22nd from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for a fun-filled day with live music, free food, games for the kids, guest speakers, and veteran support professionals. For event information, call 781-985-1551. We hope to see you there.
Looking for a fun, youth-filled South Shore musical before our high schoolers head to college? Come see Grease by Hingham Civic Music Theater, opening Friday, August 4th, for 4 performances at Hingham Town Hall's Sanborn Auditorium. The hit show is directed by Nathan Fogg. Shows start at 7:30 the first Friday and Saturday night, with an August 12th Saturday night show followed by a closing 2 p.m. Sunday matinee. Advance tickets at hcmt.org. Come enjoy Grease in Hingham's Town Hall Theater.
Plymouth Public Library Foundation is excited to announce its inaugural garden tour, taking place on Thursday, July 20th from noon to 6 p.m. This self-guided tour will allow participants to visit 6 different gardens throughout the town and speak with the gardeners to learn about their techniques, inspiration, and experiences. Additionally, from noon to 4 p.m. at the library, several environmental organizations and local garden businesses will have information and displays for visitors to enjoy, along with other special opportunities. Tickets are $30 each and can be purchased at pplfdn.org. We hope to see you there.
FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 959WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD. Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return for the second hour of Monday Night Talk here on 959WATD. Reminding you, hey, don't forget that all of our latest podcasts are up. If you have missed any of our segments, easy enough to go to the homepage of 959WATD and search for the podcast. All the podcasts of the shows that we have are indeed up. Joining us for this segment, this is going to be a fantastic and fun segment, as we have a New England author. This gentleman's name is Tom Curran. Tom is here to talk a little bit about his book, All Join Hands. This is about the Dudley Loughman and the New England country dance tradition. Tom, welcome to Monday Night Talk. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Let's talk a little bit about your book. First, before we talk about your book, tell us a little bit about yourself. Other than being an author of multiple books, what else is it that you'd like to share about your background with our audience?
Well, I grew up in Melrose, which at the time, which was the mid-50s, was morphing from partly a farm community into an absolute part of the belt of suburbia. So I was aware of some of the old ways. There was still band concerts outside the fire department. Actually, Melrose had a band. That was one of the things that they did when they weren't fighting fires. And so I had a pretty good grounding in New England traditions growing up in the 50s. My folks worked for an outfit called Northeast Airlines, which were propeller planes that pretty much operated as the Continental Trailways of New England in those days. They had government subsidies, so they flew small planes all over New England, and we were in all six states all the time. So I soaked up sites like the New Bedford Whaling Museum, and of course all of the Pilgrims and the coast of Maine and Vermont, which is where my mom was from. But anyway, I had a grounding in tradition. And then I took an interest as a young person in music. I used to listen to Ina Ginsberg's rock and roll shows on WMEX in Boston, and really developed an intense interest in music. And that turned into an exposure to the folk music scene in the 60s. I used to go to the Club 47 and other coffee houses in Boston. And then I, in the late 60s, moved to New Hampshire and lived on a farm. I had cattle and chickens and heated with wood for going on 50 years now. But at the same time, I also had a career as a conservationist. I worked for land trusts in New Hampshire and Maine, and I worked for the Pew Charitable Trusts, which I ended up, this sounds easier than it is, giving money away for conservation projects. So in the process, on that end of things, and this by now we're in the 19, say around 2000, I started driving considerable distances looking at land projects. And I had time on my hands, and I converted most of my old records to CDs and started listening to the old folk music. And then that one thing led to another, and I met Betsy Siggins, who lives in Kituit and used to manage the Club 47. And Betsy had started an archive called Folk New England and asked me to volunteer for it. So I started volunteering to collect mostly old tapes, but also promotional material. Took a real interest in the old, you know, rethinking through the old listening to coffee house tapes back when most of those Boston musicians weren't famous. A lot of them were great, and the ones that got famous later weren't. I mean, because all of this is at UMass now, we've got tapes of people like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, and you can hear the chairs scraping and ground on the floor, and people talking in between sets, and the espresso machine going off. So I was collecting stuff, and that was when I revisited the old contra dance tradition, which I had brushed up against in the 60s, and reconnected with Dudley Laughman. I wrote a book about the Boston-Cambridge folk revival about 4 years ago. And then I came up with a 1972 tape of Dudley Laughman, and had it digitized and brought it to him. He just turned 90 and said, "Hey, I thought you might want to listen to this." And in the conversation, he talked about, you know, winding down his long career and it was an amazing career. We can talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
And nobody had written it down. And I thought, maybe there's a story here.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, dancing. I know that there's country dancing. I know there's line dancing. There's country line dancing. But I never knew that there was something that was unique to this region. Where did country dancing originate, and where did the New England style
originate?
Well, the New England style of contra dancing, which is a form of line dancing. Contra was French, and it meant you were opposite each other, the men on one line and women on the other. As opposed to quadrilles, another French term, which is square dancing. Both old traditions, both founded in Europe. I think what we're talking about here is traditions that are older than even our writing, that go back into before the Middle Ages, before media, before entertainment. This is what people did in villages in Ireland and Scotland and England and France and Germany. There were folk dances, and this is a major, from all I can gather, this was a major social point. And that's what came over the water. It was something that rich and poor shared, which they shared very little in those days. But these traditions were very, very, very popular here.
Okay. How does the New England version differ from any other? Is there any tweaks or any movement that is different from anything across the water or down south?
Yep. And this is the old American story of, diversity, basically. No sooner did we get here than the tradition is basically English. But Irish people started coming over in numbers, and pretty soon that's when things like jigs became popular and much faster fiddling than was the case with the English. Then you had the French-Canadian influence, which the French influence really exacerbated during the Revolution, because we here in New England were, even though strong objections to housing British soldiers, we had lots and lots of French sailors over here during the last several years of the war. And there was a huge French dance influence, particularly around Boston. And then, of course, the French Canadians came in. And then the other thing that influenced the dance and actually influenced who did the fiddling was maritime connection, Boston, places like Westport, and York, Maine, and Portsmouth, and Newburyport, all had ships taking goods down into the Caribbean. And so you started having a steady flow of African-American, or even in some cases African sailors coming back. If you lost a sailor in the Bahamas and you needed to hire somebody, you'd hire somebody off the street. And if they came up to, let's just say, Westport, New Hampshire, Westport, Massachusetts, they'd be free to get hired on the next boat. And that group of people, African Americans, had already played an instrument like a fiddle and quickly took on that as a specialty. So you had the flavor of the islands injected into, the old English traditions. So it was a pretty lively tradition and a pretty, and one that was in a good sense mutating all the time.
If you are just tuning in, we're privileged to be speaking with Thomas Curran. He's the author of a new book, All Join Hands, Dudley Laughlin and the New England Country Dance Tradition. Let's talk a little bit about Dudley and what it was like to sit down with him and kind of get it from his point of view and put it in the book.
Well, he's an interesting guy, and I think anybody that's over 90 is de facto interesting. But he comes out of a point where he not only predates Michael Jackson and the Beatles and Elvis. I mean, he was born in 1930, and indoor plumbing was only about 40 years old in Boston at the point where he was born. And he remembers, as my dad did, people getting ice deliveries, chunks of ice delivered on horse-drawn wagons in the 30s, coal being delivered. So he was part of a different world than the one we've grown up with. And he's a young guy. He was in Arlington. He was a hockey player. He played for Arlington High. But through an unusual series of events, he ended up working summers at a dairy farm in New Hampshire, and he was exposed to the old dance ways that were, that the couple up in Fremont, New Hampshire had. And he just made the unlikely decision that that was going to be his way of life. And so he started calling dances in the 40s. And, you know, from the films and stuff I've seen back then, and the still photographs, I mean, he was not only a guy in his, you know, late teens, but he was the only guy who was young at all. So he soaked up a lot of tradition, including a lot of dances were happening, he tells me and others have, of the weekly schedule. They're dancers in Porter Square, dancers at the Boston Y, the Cambridge Y. There's a dance every night of the week. And if you wanted to go afield in Westport or up to Revere or up to Ipswich, there were dancers everywhere in the 40s. And Dudley soaked that all up. And what he didn't know, you know, he basically, you know, worked around that as his number one occupation. And he became, you know, one of the best in the business at a point where very few other people knew it.
So back about nearly 15 years ago, Laughlin actually got some interesting recognition for some of his work. I guess the NEA's National Heritage Fellowship Award. This is the nation's highest honor in the folk and traditional arts. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how people actually reacted to him receiving this award?
Yeah, because that's a key. What he couldn't have predicted, backing up a little bit, is the rush to the woods, the countryside that young people engaged in, say, from about 1965 on. And so instead of being just a guy who was, you know, quickly losing his audience because they were dying, all of a sudden there were all of these people with long hair and who wore paisley dresses who were flooding into rural New England from places like Cambridge and Amherst. Mm-hmm. You know, that became a big deal, and there weren't that many places people could go, and they flocked to these dances. And pretty soon, a whole new generation of people who were 20 or 30 years younger than Dudley started to, and he was the only source. You know, it was sort of like, to name two other people who have been recognized nationally. Like Bill Monroe is the only guy who had soaked up bluegrass from the old timers in Kentucky. B.B. King was the chief source of the blues, growing up with old timers in Mississippi and then going to Chicago and plugging in an electric Gibson and you know, teaching people the blues. And Dudley was the same thing with the contra dance. So he became known all over New England, if you were into that sort of thing. Not everybody was. But then he became really famous. And that was that crowd of people who became academics, who decided, as he approached in his 70s, that he needed to be honored, along with, you know, people like Malvina Reynolds and Mavis Staples and Pete Seeger. You know, he got that recognition from Congress and went to Washington, and that was a big deal.
So what is the state of today's country dance in New England? I mean, is it something that still can be done every weekend? Is it thriving, or is it at a lull?
Well, it was in an enforced lull. I think my sense of it is that, you know, it had some real, you know, continued to evolve. You have young people now, let's say within the last 10 years, developing even more complex dance steps. And then, of course, you had people who were really focused on tradition. So the thing has really grown, and it's coast to coast. And if you Google country dance, you'll find groups in every metropolitan area in the country, and organizations around them, and then they have gatherings. There's two sessions, week-long sessions in Maine, of Maine Fiddle Camp, where people learn. So it's a niche, but it's certainly survived a long time, and it's one that people are able to make a living at, either as instructors or as musicians. What did put a dent in that, and would put a dent in anything that involved close physical contact, was COVID.
Right.
COVID really slowed this all down. I mean, I remember going to see Dudley '92, and I made sure I had a mask on. And, you know, people stopped going to dances because you can't, you're touching everybody in the hall in the course of the night. You're grabbing their hands or you're swinging them. And, you know, you end up interacting physically with everybody in the hall. Everybody who dances shares that. And that's invigorating and wonderful and builds community, but it really was something that came to a halt. So that's just starting to come back now, people are going to dances. I was at one in Peterborough that Dudley was featured at a week ago, and that I'm going to say there were maybe there were maybe 250 people there, and I may have seen maybe a dozen masks. So we hope, we never know, and we won't know until the fall comes. But there are a lot of dances going on right now. I think if you Google contra dance, particularly New Hampshire contra dance, the state actually has a schedule.
Okay. We are, again, if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Thomas Curran. He is the author of the book, All Join Hands, Dudley Loffman and the New England Country Dance Tradition. This is a story about what happened when a 10,000-year-old musical tradition puts itself into the hands of a 17-year-old Boston boy in 1947. That's straight from the introduction itself. While we have a few minutes left with you, Tom, you're a conservationist. Can you tell me a little bit about what the connection is between the country dance and the back to the land movement at this time?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, no one could have predicted that, but, all of us who, and I think this continues now, I see it in my own kids, all of us who moved to the country or who had concerns about the direction that some things were going on in the cities and that we, you know, maybe needed to take a deep breath in our way of life and in order to preserve it. In addition to other things like cooking, there's been an increased interest in rural ways of cooking food, architecture. People learn to build post and beam buildings. I actually learned how to do that myself, which I wouldn't have guessed I would have done. Eating with wood, antiques. Music moved into all of this. And it's been interesting to me to watch every time in my lifetime when we have a major leap forward in technology, we have at the same time, we have an increased interest in the traditional arts. Certainly on a different scale, but that's when the same leaps happen. I can remember that as back in the 50s when we first launched a satellite, a rocket, into space. The number one song on the hit parade was The Ballad of Davy Crockett. And that pattern has continued. So that interest in country ways, I think, has mushroomed. And the other thing is when you move to an area, a rural area and from the city, you kind of have to, there's no welcome wagon. You kind of have to make your own way socially. And a dance is an easy way to do that. And I know that you know, people come and, you know, you bring a dish or you don't, and you can probably fill up on macaroni and cheese or tuna wiggle or whatever and, at a dance and get to know the neighbors.
Right.
You bought the old gardener place. Well, thank God. I've been worried about that building for years. That kind of thing goes on, and it's natural at a dance, and because there are so many gaps and you're talking to people. Very often you'll hear people talking right through the dance. They'll continue a conversation. It's a great place to meet people. I think, it's a social situation. When I was first coming up to the country, there were very few young women involved in the Back to the Land movement. One could say they probably did most of the work. But so you go to a contra dance to meet. I can remember in the late 60s, specifically going to a contra dance in Canterbury that Dudley ran. There was a bass player there whose sister would come up from Cambridge once in a while. And she was a very attractive, redheaded woman who took absolutely no interest in me. And that was Bonnie Raitt. You had Joan Baez showing up at the Nelson Dance and dancing with the old timers there. So there was a lot of cross pollination going on. It's a great place to meet people, and that still is, as our population is on the move, particularly right now. I mean, the real estate situation is people are moving all over the place into neighborhoods they've never been in. And, I think the dance is one way for people to, to sort of throw themselves into a social situation without the overlay of, let's say, that comes with either political meetings or necessarily religious meetings or other nonprofit portals into the community, all of which work well. But the dance is sort of like you're there and nobody asked any questions and you get to meet people in a pretty informal way.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you. We've got just a couple of moments left, enough time for you to not only tell folks where they can purchase your book and also any events you may be coming up that may be coming up in your neck of the woods as you are a resident of New Hampshire. So if they want to come and meet you, maybe have the book signed or talk to you a little bit about country dance. Let's start with where can they get the book?
Well, the easiest place right now is probably through Amazon. It's on Amazon. You can order it, and that will get shipped right to you. I've got two appearances coming up that I can mention. We're putting the fall schedule together now. I can give you my email address, and if anybody wants one made out to them, I'd be happy to do that. We've done that. I've probably sold about 400 of them that way. And the bookstores right now, the ones that I know they're at, the Harvard Bookstore in Harvard Square and Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire, and the Toadstool Bookstores in Peterborough and over in Keene is carrying them. And then we're going to be expanding this through the fall. So I think the first thing I would say would be immediately through Amazon, otherwise one of those other bookstores, or email me and I'll give you my email. As you noted, the spelling of my name is a little different from the popular sportscaster.
Yep.
In Massachusetts, who's a really good guy. It's TomCurran47@gmail.com, and I just use that 47 as a kind of a reminder of the old club 47. So it's TomCurran47@gmail.com, and if people want to email me at that address, and I'll repeat it in a minute, then I'll get them the information. It's $25 postpaid for the book, and I'm happy to inscribe it. And if the calendar works all right, you'll get my Signature and Dudley. So,
okay.
So it's TOMCUREN47@gmail.com. And the upcoming dances, we'll be adding to this, but I don't want to name something that's still in the process. Tamworth, New Hampshire on the 12th, which is a Saturday. We'll be at a dance there, and you can find at the Tamworth Library.
Yep.
There are wonderful people there. There's a good place to eat in Tamworth if you want to make the run up. It's on the way to North Conway. And at the Canterbury Shaker Village, we're going to be doing a presentation there on Sunday, August 27th. And that's just north of Concord on 93, depending on traffic, maybe an hour north of Boston, which is a really wonderful site. The Shakers started there in the 1790s. Dudley lives there, and we're drawing in some of the original musicians that Dudley first recorded with in 1965 at that one. So that you can find out about at the Shaker Village site as well.
Great. Well, Tom, we are plumb out of time, but I want to thank you so much for sharing your wisdom on New England country dance, talking about the book, and giving some background on Dudley Loffman. We hope to have you back on relatively soon, maybe in the fall, if you want to promote more of the book, and maybe we can talk about some other things when you have the time.
Well, that would be great. I really enjoyed this. I felt like it was about 5 minutes long, which means you know what you're doing. The other thing I'll just say, and we've talked about this before, we're going to try to get a performance, a dance going down in your neck of the woods. And that would be a great time to meet people sometime in the fall or winter.
Okay. And we'll keep people folks posted about that event possibly going to be down on the Cape.
Sure.
Okay. We are going to step aside. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk right here at 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Don't go without a primary care physician. Signature Healthcare is here to support you. There are so many reasons to choose Signature Healthcare for primary and specialty care for you and your family. Signature Healthcare provides trusted referrals to over 17 Signature medical specialties and direct access through their medical affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. You'll have access to their retail pharmacy and urgent care centers, providing you full access to your medical records and the ability to request medication refills through their secure patient portal. Most of all, Signature Healthcare helps you stay on top of your health through regular checkups by top quality physicians and staff. Start a relationship with Signature Healthcare today. For an appointment with a Signature Healthcare primary care physician, call 844-SHC-APPT. That's 844-742-2778. Or email appts@signature-healthcare.org. Find out more at signature-healthcare.org.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add #Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, we return for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. I can't believe that we're already halfway through the month of July. But as I always say, usually the last segment of the radio show is the best. It's the best way to finish. It's the punctuation. And it so happens that we are privileged to be able to speak to a couple of members of the Causeway Kings, skating in as not only as a center, but also defenseman. We have Adam Clancy joining us. Adam, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
And, of course, hoping to provide us with a Vezina Cup-like program or segment, we have Mr. Benny Rabbi.
How are you doing, Kev? Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, gentlemen, I have brought you back for us to kind of talk a little bit about what has happened since the last time we talked. When we had high hopes, we did a segment thinking that the Boston Bruins, the 22-23 version of the Bruins, were going to be at least making it to the Stanley Cup Finals. But Adam, Clance, it's not to be.
Well, there's a lot going on there. I'm actually calling this the Cassidy curse. You know, this is a perfect example that the regular season means nothing. Playoff hockey, as a retired player, playoff hockey is a different breed of hockey. The Bruins just didn't have it. I think they skated into the playoffs thinking, hey, we just had the best, you know, just set records in the NHL for wins, points, all this hardware that we just got, we're going to skate right through. No, they didn't. The Florida Panthers owned them from game one.
But was it something that it seemed as though that the Panthers, correct me if I'm wrong, I think any team that makes it into the playoffs, if they heat up at the right time, it doesn't matter if they are the number one seed or the number eight seed, if your goalie gets hot between the pipes, if you guys get on a roll, you can go right to the finals. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, look back years ago with the LA Kings. They had multiple years in a row where they squeaked in last minute as the eighth seed, and they went on and won the cup. It's just the physicality in playoff hockey goes to a whole different level. And that's what happened. The Bruins physically got knocked around the ice for seven games. There's no doubt about it.
What do you think, Benny? I mean, Florida did go on to be the, you know, Eastern Conference, you know, representation in the Cup series. Your thoughts?
It's true. You know, I thought the point at which it all went wrong was in the last two or three games of the season. We go to Montreal for the big last, you know, game of the season with the Habs. Berge gets hurt, playing in a game that he never should have been in. But as we found out later, it was because his father was not doing well and he really wanted to have his father be there in attendance. Montreal, the team they grew up watching, totally understandable professionally at the same time. My dude, what are you doing? And then the same thing kind of for the goaltending. Vezina, talk about Vezina Trophy. Yeah, man, you might have won that award, but you got yourself hurt somehow 3 games before the playoffs. I won't forget it, and Clance, I'm sure you remember the moment too. It was on TV. He goes down to make a standard save. He stayed down just an extra couple of ticks, looked down at that right hip, and I saw it on TV at that very moment. They said, oh, no. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. And, of course, look how it ended up turning out. The regular season means nothing. Capital N. And you know what? A capital G, too. Why not? It means nothing, Kevin. And that's a perfect example. You know, and how awkward. You know, congratulations to the guys that won in the mm-hmm. award show afterwards. But how painful as a player and as a coach does that have to be? Oh, congratulations, you know, Coach of the Year and Vezina and all these great things. But you kind of held in your head in shame going, man, that wasn't what we were shooting for. Mm. Not even close.
But knowing that they were the one team that at least took the Panthers to the limit during the conference, you know, games, is that any kind of a consolation
prize? That makes me feel worse. They yeah. should not have been a game 7. There should not have been a game 5 or 6 or any of those other. Yeah. It just, my head, Kevin, my head.
I wasn't expecting them to come in and sweep the Panthers. Panthers are a great team. They're a hard, gritty team. And, you know, I'm a strong believer in hard work outweighs talent all day long.
Every
and
the
Bruins just got outworked. I think part of the blame, honestly, is on Montgomery, because why would you wait till game 7 to play Jeremy Swayman, knowing that Allmark, they even came out and said it was a debilitating injury? Like, that just makes no sense to me. I mean, it is what it is, and if I was Swayman, I'd be like, listen, I've done my time. I deserve to be a starter. All of Boston knows he deserves to be a starter. I'd be requesting a trade to get out of here.
Which he absolutely did.
Yep.
You know, what was the point of running a tandem goaltending team all season long, making such a successful idea out of the concept, too, at that? Probably
too
one of the
hugging.
Most successful experiments we've seen in a tandem like
yeah.
that. Only to ignore it at the moment where it means the most. You know, and Swayman could have been any one of those first couple of games. If game one goes the way it goes, and it's very obvious that, hey, hold on here, Allmark's having a problem, whatever that problem is, you got to nip that in the bud right there. If he's good to go later in the series, later in the playoffs, great. You throw the kid in up front, they're both ready to go, and that is a management and coaching issue.
So were we fully expecting the Knights to win? Were you expecting Bruce Cassidy's squad to win?
I had it in my gut that they were going to, really? Be honest.
The storyline made sense.
The storyline made so much sense. Jack Eichel brought his game to a whole new level this season. Him and Marchessault, they were just gelling like the two best players in the league. Hill, the goalie, stood on his head the entire playoffs. They just, Eichel, yeah, he's a star, no doubt about it, but that team just works hard. And that's all, it's what it takes is hard work, grit, and determination to win, and that's what they did.
Was Cassidy not a player coach? Like, there are coaches that are, they coach their players into the ground, and then there are ones that are like, okay, I'll give you a couple of days off, if anything, they're more friendly with their squad.
So I actually was listening to the Spin Chickers podcast, right after they won the Cup, and they had a few of the players on, Marchessault being one of them. They asked, what type of coach is Cassidy? And they said, he's a hard coach. He's an old school. Like, he's in your face. He's swearing up and down the bench, but he's got his players back. And sometimes some players don't take kindly to that. They don't like being coached hard. They feel like, I'm a pro. I can do what I want. And now, the Vegas Golden Knights, they bought into his coaching style, and now look at them. I think they're still celebrating.
Do you think they return to the Lord Stanley finals again next year?
Tough call.
I mean, this might be because we haven't delved into free agency just yet. Mm-hmm. But let's while we're here, Adam Clancy and Benny Rabbi from the Causeway Kings, a podcast that you can hear on most outlets, and also they also have a TV show. Let's talk a little bit about free agency here. Thoughts on this being a weak free agency class? And how the Boston Bruins did. I mean, I know there's some people who are just celebrating because they're pulling their, Milan Lucic, jerseys out of the closet going, oh, I thought this thing was done forever.
Yeah, funny thing about that. There's a lot of hockey fans out there, Kevin, who are just fans of the game in general, fans of just the Bruins, and then just fans because it's a Boston team and they really don't know the meat and potatoes of anything about it. But it's interesting because we were talking about it a little bit before we sat down here. The reunion tour, wasn't that last year?
Supposed to be. Unfortunately, I think Krejci's going back to play with
I heard he's going back to the Czech.
Yeah. Doesn't he own that team, though?
I think he's a part owner.
That's
Yaga. Yaga owns a team outright.
Oh, okay.
His dad owned it for, I think, 28 years, and then Yaga took it over.
See, that's why you bring the experts in. See, they know these things. Me, I'm just the guy who asks the questions. I thought, interesting, if maybe this was a few years ago, if they had re-signed Lucic, Shattenkirk, Van Riemsdyk. I mean, wow, these are decent guys.
Yeah, but a few years ago, absolutely.
But you're giving them the money says it all. You're giving them veteran minimum contracts.
It just doesn't make Luch okay. I can see signing Luch. He's loves being a Bruin. Started his career here. To me, this is a sign. It's one final ride for him. He's going to retire as a Bruin.
That's right.
Great. Awesome. Is Shattenkirk?
But don't they do the one-day contract thing in hockey? Or
Sometimes.
It depends on
they did that.
Happens.
I think the last time did that was Chara, and before that was Mike Modano.
Yep.
With Dallas. The Shattenkirk signing, I don't hate it. He's still got some gel in his game. He is obviously on the older side. The JVR, James Van Riemsdyk signing, like,
That's a head-scratcher for
that
me.
That is just,
we already have a Derek Forbert. What do we need another one for?
Dumb.
Yep.
Like, he's done nothing in the last 4 or 5 years in Philly.
He's been a journeyman all the way around.
He's just, when he came into the league, he was a top guy. He was an all-star. I don't know what these signings are going to do for us. To be honest with you, they need to beef up the back end. I wouldn't have gone out and spent money on JVR. I would have taken that money and went out and signed another defenseman.
A big one at that.
So here's the other head scratcher. Before the free agent signing, so two head scratchers. A, what the hell happened to Twitter? Because I was trying to follow, and for some reason I I had run out of space, or I wasn't able to.
Oh, you don't have a paid account.
I had exceeded my I had exceeded my limit of views. I only get, 600 views a day now?
Thanks,
unless
Elon.
I have a verified account. But that's not the check mark. Is that a check mark?
Oh, is it? I thought that was all the same one.
Check mark is verified.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know there was an a la carte for Twitter these days. But okay. Anyways, but, you know, trying to keep up to date with the different signings. But Taylor Hall being traded away. What gives?
So that's just about Chicago building around Bedard all day. They're going to give that kid every single top-end talent they can find.
Ben, all due respect, I don't give a rat's ass about Chicago. I care about
that.
The black and gold and Taylor Hall, and you coerced this kid. You know, he kind of proved when you traded for him that he had the wherewithal. What happened?
That trade was to clear up cap space to try to sign Tyler Bertuzzi long-term.
How'd that go?
Not well.
Not well at all.
How'd that go?
I for sure thought, and to be honest with you, Taylor Hall was probably our number two guy in the playoffs, point-wise, production-wise, yep. Being noticed on the ice every shift.
Yep.
It's definitely like, okay, he's traded away. Let's get Bertuzzi locked in. He's younger. He's got more, you know, a lot of tread left on the tires. He can put up the points.
He's that pest in front of the net.
Yeah, he's a bigger, stronger Marchand.
I was going to say that. He's a younger version.
You know?
And now he plays for the Leafs.
And
for a year.
And I can see, okay, you know, Taylor Hall going to Chicago, yeah, mentoring Bedard, first-round pick overall, same as Bedard, Hall. They brought in Corey Perry. I get that. But you got nothing in return.
Cap space. That's what you
and
got.
Now you take that cap space that you were banking on for Tyler Bertuzzi. I read an article that he came out and said that management was very disorganized, and that was one of the reasons why he did not want to re-sign in Boston.
Really?
Ooh, yes. That's a telling
now,
sign.
True article, I don't know. Could be a made-up one. I don't know. But most of the time, I believe those articles. He goes off and signs with Toronto for 1 year, $5.5 million. Toronto signs Max Domi for, was it 3 years?
Yeah. It's,
you know, his dad is a legend in that.
Indeed.
You know, now they're taking all this cap space that they freed up, you know, trading Hall and signing guys that are like a year or two younger than me.
Yeah.
Or I just turned 40 2 weeks ago. JVR, I think, is 38 years old, 37 years old.
Yeah, I would say they're in the mid 30s, 35, you know? 36. They're in that area.
But they're on the tail end of everything.
Exactly. Back nine all day. Yes, I agree.
This almost sounds like. I could see, okay, you want to bring guys like that in who are veterans, long-term players in the league. If you had a pipeline of young talent that you're trying to groom, you don't. All your young talent already plays. You already have McAvoy. You already have Marchand, who's not even old, young. You know, you got Pasta, but then you have nothing in the AHL. Like, okay,
literally.
Fabian LaSalle. I'm calling it right now. He's a first-round bust.
You think?
Yes. Really? He hasn't even put up over 50 points in the AHL. And he's supposed to be a first-round pick. The last time in the World Juniors, 0 points in 7 games.
So I guess it's kind of a good thing that in this particular draft that happened a couple of weeks ago, that they didn't have a first or a second round because it would have been a waste anyways.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Now, they do have, you know, one upside in their development camp right now is the defenseman that they signed out of Ohio State. I can't remember his name. The last name's Lowry or something like that.
Oh, they had a development camp about a week ago.
Just ended yesterday. Yep.
This kid that they just, they signed him, you know, mid of last year out of Ohio State. He's 6'5". He can move. They say he plays a lot like a Victor Hedman, but is kind of a skater like a Cal McCarr type, but has some grit in his game, too. Mm. And I've heard he was turning heads at development camp.
Wasn't there another kid? So I was reading something about another kid who, right place, right time during development camp. And while he doesn't have the great shot, and he doesn't come with a great pedigree, but he has that something. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh, McLaughlin, the kid from BC.
Not McLaughlin. Played a few games. It was another kid. I was reading an article.
Oh, Beecher?
Might be Beecher.
John Beecher.
Yeah, he's another first round bust.
Yeah.
He's. he's just not good. Like, he was at Michigan. His points went down every single year. He went from being a first liner to like a third or fourth liner. He does absolute nothing in the AHL for Providence. He's another first round bust.
So here's my question. If you're having all these first round busts, would you not, as management, be questioning the guys who are staff? Yeah, the guys, your director of scouting and the people under him. If you're bringing in individuals who are not somehow finding their way into the parent club within, you know, a 2 to 4 year window, you have to question whether or not you're not able to hit on these, Ben.
Absolutely, and point in case, just look at the middle of this whole last season. What did the Bruins do with one of their random free agent signings that almost derailed the entire team just on the distraction alone? The scouting staff went out and signed that kid. I don't remember his name. That's how unimportant it was. But
Mitchell
something or another.
Yeah.
And this is the kid that abused another individual.
Oh, yeah.
With, you know,
special needs.
Just,
yep.
You
can't, special needs. Yeah.
Got kicked out. Like he lost a scholarship at North Dakota.
The fact that someone in the Bruins organization was allowed and unaware of those situations and
but
brought this person forward and management signed off on it.
Yeah, well, he was a free agent that was
declined.
He was drafted by someone else.
He was drafted by the Coyotes.
Coyotes, correct.
And
Coyotes
then said, all of this came out of what he did to one of his fellow classmates, and they released him. And then he went and played juniors in the USHL, lit it up there, was supposed to go to North Dakota on a full boat. North Dakota revoked their scholarship. And then he was kind of just sitting around, and the Bruins decided to sign him out of nowhere for just pure stupidity.
Mm.
Here's my take on the Bruins scouting staff. Everybody in there has been part of the Bruins organization for years upon years. They have P.J. Axelsson as their European scout. You got, you know, ex-Bruins as assistant coaches. You have ex-Bruins as development coaches. Like, it's almost like a little cult.
Like, a club.
You think of it. You have your GM is an ex-Bruin. Your president is a legend ex-Bruin. Now, fast-forwarding to coaching, right? You bring in someone from the outside of the organization who turns the team around and has a legendary regular season.
Sure.
That I think that they're too tight-knit, and they're not willing to expand their horizons to stop bringing... Like, why would you not want to go out and get John LeClair and bring him in as your development coach? Instead, he stays in Philly. Like, why would you not bring someone, like, bring in a different voice?
Is a part of this ownership?
Absolutely.
It's always been a part ownership.
I mean, they lucked out, you know, 10, 11 years ago winning a cup. I hate to say that. You know, every now and then, I hate to say it, the sun does shine on that dog's ass.
Absolutely.
It happens, you know, and then the clouds come by. And that's what happened the next couple times they went to the cup. No disrespect. I mean, I'm a lifelong Bruins fan. But, you know, you get tired of, you know, oh, well, we made the playoffs. Oh, we made it, you know, oh so deep.
Yeah, it's...
It used to be just beat the Habs. And we don't even do that anymore.
Yeah the lunch pail guys. Go out and beat the Habs. That's your, you know, your cup run right there.
Right. Literally, nobody even cared if you won the Stanley Cup. That was the extra, but you had to get through the Habs to do it first. That dynamic has been out of sync for years now. And this last season, I feel like, was the first season in years that we've even been able to play in Montreal.
Yeah. Because of COVID and everything.
It's supposed to be four or five real tough divisional games every single year. That's part of the tradition. And that's been ruined by scheduling, which we could spend a whole nother hour
absolutely
talking about that. But
again, if you are just tuning in, I can't believe we've already kind of burned through 20 minutes of our conversation. We got a few more minutes left with Clance and Benny Rabbi, again, guys from Causeway Kings podcast, regular podcast, talking about hockey. How about, do we want to kind of take a look around the league? How has the league changed for next season? Have you gentlemen had a chance to take a look and go, who will be a real contender, somebody who's going to float to the top of the division, and who is sinking like a lead weight is attached to their pants?
It's,
Ben?
It's funny with the off seasons now, because it used to be such minimal, fine-tuned changes in personnel and coaching and this and that. But ever since, 2015 on, every offseason is just a complete and total league shakeup. I mean, look at Vegas, for example. They win the Cup less than 72 hours later. They're already making moves, cutting players, signing players, this, that, and the other thing. Other teams in our area here, you know, Tampa, Carolina, got significantly better.
Sure.
The free agency in the offseason now really focuses on the individuals, players. Point in case, look at Vladimir Tarasenko. He's having the most dramatic time of it right now. The Bruins are also potentially in on him, I've seen in some conversations.
Oh,
but
he's
changing agents in the middle of this whole thing. And that's become a common
Well, they're hoping that Bergeron comes back as well, aren't they?
I thought I saw he was officially hanging him up.
I haven't heard that he's officially
hanging him up. I haven't heard that either.
I've heard rumors that they're trying to get him to come back for one more year.
And he just had his fourth child, and there's so much conversation going on around
all
him.
All the reason to come back.
There are multiple rumors. I've also heard that maybe he might even wait until later on this year, past training camp, past the start of the season, and then maybe play if they are a contender or they're somewhere in the conversation, maybe starting in December. I've heard that as well. But again, unconfirmed until we hear it out of his mouth.
That's right. That's right.
I think two of the teams that I think are going to be the teams to watch out for next year, I hate to say it, Toronto Maple Leafs.
Hurricanes,
and I'm actually going to throw a third one there. Edmonton Oilers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
You have...
Absolutely.
I look at who's left out there still that's requesting trades. John Gibson, top elite goalie, wants out of Anaheim. Could absolutely play in one of those markets.
No doubt.
Connor Hellebuck, he wants out of Winnipeg. Edmonton needs a goalie. He's used to playing in the Canadian market. He's a Vezina winner. He's an all-star. He's young. And Edmonton just signed someone else that McDavid played with in juniors. They're now reunited.
Fantastic.
Like, Edmonton's going to be a powerhouse.
And they've also been frustrated for how many years
now?
Yeah,
McDavid deserves to win.
Over.
Colorado got better in the offseason. Pittsburgh got a little bit better in the offseason.
As much as we love the black and gold, the league overall is such a fun one to watch, and it's unlike any other sport or industry in the world, Kevin, as you know. And it's just such a great time to be a hockey fan these days.
But it's so mind-boggling that when I looked at the beginning of last season and knowing that you had Marchand and McAvoy who were going to be possibly on the shelf, there were a lot of, you know, unanswered questions. You're like, if they're able to eke in and get that eighth spot, great.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know that they were going to be, you know, as good as they were. Under this particular coach, but yet to be, you know, to lay an egg come the first round of the playoffs. Nobody knew. So I feel that, like, we're going into this next season, and, you know, are they going to actually be the dud that we thought they were going to be last year?
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Rockton.